of boredom. But first, we have the latest news from NPR. Hope you stay tuned for more local news on KHSU.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The White House is trying to regain its footing just weeks into the Trump presidency after it was prompted to sever ties with a central member of its national security team. Last night, Michael Flynn resigned as national security advisor after he conceded that he misrepresented his conversations with the Russian ambassador late last year. As NPR's Scott Horsley explains, the White House maintains Flynn's departure was not the result of a legal violation, but rather a loss of trust.
White House spokesman Sean Spicer says the president first learned of his national security advisor's false statements about 2.5 weeks ago. That's when the Justice Department alerted a White House lawyer Flynn's conversation with the Russian ambassador had included a discussion of U.S. sanctions, something Flynn had denied. Spicer insists there was nothing illegal about the conversation itself. The problem, he says, was Flynn's misleading accounts of the call to the vice president and others.
We got to a point not based on a legal issue, but based on a trust issue, where the level of trust between the president and General Flynn had eroded to the point where he felt he had to make a change.
Spicer adds Flynn's discussion of sanctions was not authorized or directed by then-president-elect Trump. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says there needs to be a transparent probe into whether Flynn committed a crime.
Was General Flynn directed or authorized to do what he did? What was the extent of his conversations and contacts with Russia?
The Senate's top Democrat called on Republicans to also support an investigation. Nearly 40 years after New York City first grader went missing on his way to the school bus stop, a jury has convicted former store clerk Pedro Hernandez in Eitan Pates' kidnapping and murder. The victim's father, Sam Pates, says he's relieved.
I'll tell you, it's about time. It really is. It's about time.
Hernandez's attorneys argue their client's confession was a result of mental illness, including hallucinations. The child's body was never found. Fed Chair Janet Yellen painted a mostly upbeat picture of the economy in testimony before the Senate Banking Committee today. NPR's John Itzy reports Yellen also said it's too early to know what effect President Trump's economic policies will have.
President Trump has promised big tax cuts and more spending on infrastructure. Those promises have led private economists and organizations like the World Bank and IMF to boost their forecasts for U.S. growth. But senators noted the Fed's forecast has not changed, and they asked Yellen why. She said while the Fed recognizes there may be significant economic policy changes,
we don't yet have enough clarity on what changes will be put in place to clearly factor those policy changes into the economic outlook.
Nevertheless, Yellen said the Fed's moderate economic forecast still implies 3 interest rates hike by the Fed this year. John Itzy, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR.
Good afternoon. This is KHSU's Del Norte News Team with the North Coast Update. I'm Susan Andrews.
I'm Lupe Gutierrez.
I'm Jan Morehouse. A few weeks back, Deborah Kravitz, Director of Nutrition Services for the Del Norte County Unified School District, was in the KHSU studio here and spoke just ahead of the California Collective Action Day that was held Thursday, January 26th.
So the California Thursdays Network includes 71 public school districts, large and small, urban, rural, and suburban, with over 2,900 schools in 28 counties across the state. Del Norte County is one of the first districts to join the movement, and we're really proud of the fact that we've taken that on.
Kravitz explains that California Thursdays is a program that focuses on bringing California foods into California school nutrition programs. It's a collaboration between the Center for Equal Literacy and the network of districts like Del Norte.
In Del Norte County, we've even narrowed that scope, and we're trying to bring in more local foods, not just California-grown foods. For example, last year we were able to offer a California Thursday meal once a month, and we were able to feature local organic grass-fed beef from Oat Hill Farms, which is the Palmer Westbrook Ranch in Smith River, as well as cheese from our local cheese factory, Brumiano's, sour cream from Humboldt Creamery, and then a variety of different fruits and vegetables grown from some of our local farms. This year, we took it upon ourselves to offer California Thursdays at least twice a month. Ultimately, our goal on this journey is to bring California Thursdays to Del Norte students every Thursday.
On the Collective Action Day back in late January, Kravitz says the local school district celebrated with all the other districts participating in the California Thursdays program, noting that over 500,000 student lunches in the state would be freshly prepared. Kravitz told the North Coast Update why she feels that participation in this program is valuable.
By the time today's kindergartners finish high school, they may have eaten well over 4,000 school meals. School food represents a big opportunity, and California schools serve nearly 1 billion meals annually with support from over $2 billion in federal and state funding. By serving a freshly prepared meal of regionally sourced ingredients one day per week, California Thursdays creates an achievable first step to changing a system that favors highly processed, less nutritious foods.
Kravitz said that on the Collective Action Day back in January, the district featured the Alexander Family Echo Dairy Farms grass-fed beef, joining Ode Hill Farms, another local source of beef for the district. She further explained that the district is also now going to be participating in the Humboldt Del Norte Cattlemen's Association, which will be offering a monthly donation of beef.
So we'll be able to increase the amount of times we're able to offer local beef into our school menus. And one last notice, the high school is continuing to offer local fish. They've been serving fish tacos monthly, and the fish is being brought in by our local fishermen.
For the North Coast Update, I'm Jan Morehouse.
Last Friday at 5 a.m., the Klamath River crested at 41.65 feet, the fourth highest level on record. The National Weather Service reports that this knocked a previous flood of 40.52 feet December 29th of 2005 to fifth place. Del Norte Triplicate reporter Jessica Sejnar writes that the waters were just under the moderate flood stage classification of 42 feet. One lane of Highway 169 was affected by flooding. A few campers at Golden Bear RV Resort on U.S. Highway 101 were asked to evacuate. And Del Norte's Emergency Services Manager Cindy Henderson told Sejnar the field on either side of Requa Road looked like an ocean. Henderson said that she was notified by Caltrans late Thursday night that they were prepared to shut down U.S. 101 if needed. And the Klamath Volunteer Fire Department, Yurok tribal officials, and Del Norte Search and Rescue were stationed in Klamath Glen in case floodwaters isolated the community. School at Margaret Keating was canceled Friday, and the bus service to and from Klamath was also canceled. But overall, Henderson said she felt we dodged a bullet. By about 10:30 Friday morning, Klamath Beach Road on the east side of U.S. 101 was the only road still completely underwater. Henderson said that the road was probably underwater about 6 to 8 feet beneath the bridge. She explained that the Klamath Beach Road is impacted when water levels are at minor flood stage of 38 feet, noting that they had worked closely with Rezzichini to make sure residents were notified that they were going to become isolated. This includes about a dozen homes. The Triplicate article notes that the series of warm, moist systems that caused the Klamath to swell dumped 3.35 inches of rain on Crescent City in 48 hours, and the mountains above Crescent City received 7.19 inches. National Weather Service meteorologist Matthew Kidwell told Sejnar that Crescent City had received 63.07 inches of rain from October through midnight Friday, and the norm for the entire year is 64.03. Despite all the rains and the high waters on the Klamath, U.S. District Judge William H. Orrick ordered the Bureau of Reclamation to increase the flows from the Iron Gate Dam, lower most of a series of power dams on the Klamath River, in an effort to dislodge and flush out polychaete worms. The Triplicate writes that these worms host a parasite that causes hemorrhaging and necrosis in the intestines of salmonoids in the river. Increased flows were reported to begin this coming Friday through next Monday, though Henderson says she was told Congressman Doug LaMalfa, representing California's 1st Congressional District, was able to stop it. For the North Coast Update, I'm Lupe Gutierrez.
Light to moderate rains continue this week, and that concludes this edition of the North Coast Update, a collaborative effort by KHSU's Del Norte News Team.
This is the community calendar for Tuesday, February 14th, 2017. St. Innocent Orthodox Church is opening its doors to the community tonight at 7 for a choral concert featuring the world-renowned St. Petersburg-based vocalists, the Kovenets Quartet, in a single performance of sacred Eastern Christian traditional and Slavic folk songs. Go to eurekafirstchurch.org for reservations. The Humboldt County Department of Health and Human Services mobile outreach is at the Willow Creek Community Resource Center tomorrow from 9:30 to 1:30 for assistance with CalFresh, Medi-Cal, in-home support services, veteran services, and child support, plus onboard mental health clinician counseling and support case management link-up. Call 441-4650. The Humboldt Senior Resource Center's Adult Day Health and Alzheimer's Services is offering caregiver support groups tomorrow afternoon from 1 to 2 at Adult Day Health and Alzheimer's Library, 1910 California Street in Eureka, and Thursday afternoon from noon to 1 in the Fireplace Room at the United Methodist Church in Fortuna. Call 444-8254, extension 3203, or go online to humsenior.org. Humboldt State University's International Education Week continues tomorrow afternoon with a study abroad student panel presentation at 2, International Film Night from 6:30 to 9, a student presentation by Sarah Sedlak on Let's Talk Sex in Kenya Thursday morning at 10, a teacher panel Thursday afternoon at 1 on Teaching English as a Second Language. For a complete schedule, go online to humboldt.edu/IEW. The Northtown Coffee Shop is hosting a book reading, discussion, and signing tomorrow afternoon from 5 to 6:30 of local Humboldt County author and HSU graduate Brian Radzin's new sequel to his Search for Truth book series at 1603 G Street in Arcata. Go online to brianradzin.com. The North Coast Community Garden Collaborative is seeking support from the community of donations of seeds and plant starts for growing food, irrigation supplies, tools including gloves of all sizes, organic fertilizers and amendments, mulches, lumber for building raised beds, and funds. Call Debbie at 269-2071. This is Craig Kurumata inviting you to listen to KHSU's Community Calendar weekdays during Morning Edition on the KHSU Magazine and Saturdays during Weekend Edition. You may also read the week's calendar on the web at khsu.org. Please send information about nonprofit events to KHSU Community Calendar, 1 Harpst Street, Arcata, California, 95521. You can submit calendar items at KHSU's website and email calendar@khsu.org.
Today's guests on the KHSU Magazine are here to talk about the Authors Hall celebration that's taking place today. The HSU Authors Hall is located on the second floor of the HSU Library and is a permanent and physical collection of books and a virtual collection of articles, CDs, and DVDs recognizing HSU faculty, staff, students, and alumni for their scholarship and creative work. Each spring, they celebrate the works published during the previous year, and this year's celebration takes place today from 3:30 to 5 p.m. in the HSU Library on the second floor. We're joined today by scholarly communications librarian Kyle Morgan, who's presenting this Authors Hall celebration today and also manages the HSU Press. Kyle is joined by two authors featured in the HSU Authors Hall, HSU Emeritus Professor James Gash. He taught French and Francophone studies at Humboldt State until 2006 when he retired. And James received two Fulbright Senior Scholar grants to teach and conduct research in Africa and has published three textbooks dedicated to the study of West African literature. And his most recent publication, published by the Humboldt State University Press, is African Mask from the collection of James Gash. And James and Kyle are also joined by Dr. Joseph Diame. He's a professor in the World Languages and Cultures Department at HSU. And Dr. Diame teaches courses in French and Francophone studies, including African storytelling, French thought and colonialism, citizenship and identity in the French Caribbean, Francophone popular music and political discourse, and North African women and decolonization, and what is the French dream. He also teaches French and Wolof, the language of Dr. Diame's homeland of Senegal. In 2012, Dr. DMA published his book, From the Colonial Plantation to the Inner Cities, Negritude and Francophone Postcolonial Discourse. Thank you so much, Kyle, James, and Joseph, for being our guests here today on the KHSU Magazine. Really excited to have you here to help people learn about HSU authors and the HSU Authors Hall celebration that's happening today.
Thank you very much. This is just such a great idea for an event. You know, it's Valentine's Day, and how does the library and the office of the provost celebrate Valentine's Day? And we do it by showing our love for Humboldt State University authors and readers. And so this is our third annual author celebration, and we're honoring all the Humboldt State authors who published their scholarship and creative works this last year. The event is open to everyone. It's from 3:30 to 5 p.m. It's at the second floor of the library at the Authors Hall. That's right next to the fishbowl. There's going to be speakers. There's going to be cake. There's going to be refreshments. And it's really my honor to be sitting here next to one of those speakers and an author from our own Humboldt State University Press. He published African Masks from the collection of James Gash, and he's joined by Professor Joseph DMA. And they're going to talk about this book and the context and how it came to be.
Thank you so much for joining us, James and Joseph. Thank you, Kyle. So, James, tell us about your book, African Masks, from the collection of James Gash. I know a lot of us may have seen the beautiful show at the HSU. Was it the Reese Bullen Gallery?
Yes, it was, Claire.
And so now we get a chance to enjoy these masks again in your book. Can you tell us a bit about how the book came together?
Well, I've been excited to work with Kyle on this, on the book. The book comes from the exhibition curated by Michelle McCall Wallace and her students in the program, in the gallery program. That was back in last year, in February, March. It was really wonderful to teach with Joseph DMA a seminar on cultures of West Africa, at the same time having the mask next door. Students could listen to us and then link those cultures that we were speaking of to the mask and ask us questions about the mask. Joseph is from Senegal. I spent a number of years working and traveling and living in that area. I love to go back. This book, this small book that Kyle and I have put together, captures the gallery, the 20 or so masks that were part of the gallery exhibition at the time. It also contextualizes where the masks come from, who has carved these masks, and what those carvers bring to their villages, the place of carving in the villages. So we based the seminar around these masks because this book, it was my desire to bring that a strong social context. So something that I must say that I always felt that I didn't always get in a museum. So Joseph will appreciate this. We come from this from a literary background, a social background. So those masks represent that. What I think it's important for us to say here too, that these traditions, these cultural traditions are being lost in West Africa. And these are traditional societies. The societies represented here come from Mali, the Bamana and the Dogon of Mali, and the Bwa and the Mossi people, peoples of Burkina Faso. But religious pressure, different world visions, a more metropolitan, a globalized way of looking at the world. This all means that these masks are disappearing. And this was, I think, our way to capture at a certain time what we know of these societies now and the importance that these masks play in these societies. Thank you, Claire.
Are there people, just as a cultural people hanging on or learning, relearning cultural traditions, or really taking an interest in preserving cultural traditions? Are you finding that there's a lot of effort to preserve and grow these traditions to make sure they're not lost in Burkina Faso and Mali?
Yeah. So, in the interviews in this small book that I have in front of me and that's in the library, by the way, HSU Library. I also want to mention the work that Dean Oberlander has done to create this. He and Kyle have given us a gift that we just didn't have here on campus
of
before.
The Humboldt State University Press.
But getting back to your question, the youth of West Africa, and Joseph perhaps can bring a even more personal note into this, is they're looking, they're going to big cities, they're going elsewhere to work, and also, as indicated in the interviews, Christianity and Islam are becoming stronger there. Different aspects of Christianity, different waves of Islam, and all of that detracts from traditional societies. So we're losing those traditional societies. We're losing the idea of apprenticeship. So there are the old maskers, the old mask carvers are dying, unfortunately, and without apprenticeships.
Well, and Joseph, you're going to actually be taking this book on further and working with students and translating the book. Can you tell us about what's next for this African Mask book and your studies abroad?
Yes, thank you, Claire. It's the idea is to make of this. Now, this is going to be a community building project. I do plan to offer, in the Department of World Languages and Cultures, specifically in the French and Francophone Studies program, we would like to offer a course next semester, a translation course where we're going to have students. I'm going to be working with a group of students, and the objective will be to translate this book. So this book is, the plan is to translate in French, and it is my understanding that it's also being translated in Spanish. So we have a diversity of means to access, this material, but also present a different type of literacy. Another aspect of it is that people who are interested, specifically students, if they're interested, they could embark with us. They can travel with me. I'll be directing a study abroad program to Senegal, and it's going to be a 10-week program from May 29, 2017, to August 4, 2017. So students will go to Senegal. They'll be taking classes dealing with multicultural history of Africa, religions and cultures of Africa, and the third one will be social justice and the environment in Africa. So they'll be taking classes in the morning. In the afternoon, we'll be visiting sites. In addition to all of that, students will have the opportunity to take to do an internship or a service learning. So it's really a good way to another way to access all the material, and obviously masks will be definitely on the agenda.
That sounds like an incredible learning experience. Mm-hmm. We're out of time. I'm so sorry, but if you have time to get to the second floor of the HSU library today, mm-hmm. please join these fine people, Kyle Morgan, Dr. James Gash, and Dr. Joseph Dime. They'll be available to talk with you about this book and many other topics. Thank you so much. HSU Authors Hall celebration, 3:30 to 5 o'clock today. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Up in the morning and out to school.
School Days, a North Coast perspective on education that takes listeners beyond the ABCs to D for diversity. Good afternoon. I'm Susan Andrews, school psychologist educated at Humboldt State University and now serving students in the Del Norte County Unified School District.
I'm bored.
I'm bored.
Chairman of the board.
I got too much time to think. Gonna drive myself to the drink. I think I'll have another one.
A 2010 article from the Mercola Health Network cites experts who suggest there's a possibility that the more bored you are, the more likely you are to die early, citing research that showed that among 7,500 London civil service workers completing surveys about boredom, those who reported they'd been very bored were 2.5 times more likely to die of a heart problem than those who hadn't reported being bored. A 2013 article written by Kirsten Weir for the American Psychological Association cites James Dankert, PhD, a professor of cognitive neuroscience at the University of Waterloo, who found that people highly prone to boredom perform poorly on tasks that require sustained attention and are more likely to show increased symptoms of both ADHD and depression. Madison Taylor, who writes for Daily Ohm, suggests that the sense of feeling bored in life can be an indicator that we need to be proactive in creating change. Taylor talks about those times we may feel things aren't moving along fast enough for us and that the world is passing us by, maybe even to the point that time seems to stand still and we're simply bystanders in our own lives. Or she cites these other times where it seems like there's nothing new left for us to experience and that we are locked into a never-ending cycle of stasis. So she suggests that if we actually take the time to listen to these feelings, we will probably notice more going on beneath the surface, like perhaps our apprehension to venture out into the unknown. Taylor purports that by taking a new look at how we live our lives, it will be easier to break through our sense of boredom and enter into a more positive state of being. Because boredom can lead us down the path to despondency, acknowledging our feelings and then setting an intention to alter just one small thing in our life can give us a much more positive outlook. Like maybe some of these boredom busters from reachout.com. Australia.
Go outside, enjoy the sun and have a picnic with friends. Bring a camera, you can never take too many photos. Ditch modern communication for a day, send a postcard instead. Receiving mail will make someone else's day and you never know, you might get a postcard in return. Of course, you can't forget some good old exercise. Get out that ball that's been sitting in the cupboard for years. You don't need a whole team. Just shoot some hoops or play some one-on-one. Try cooking, then sharing your food with friends. Ding-dong dishing them at someone's doorstep is a good form of delivery. Making someone else smile will make you both feel good.
This act of change allows us to step outside of ourselves and discover new and exciting things that are often already present in our everyday lives. Taylor notes that simple things, such as eating a healthier diet, taking a new class, or joining a club are all ways in which we can go beyond our comfort zone and explore the wonder that exists all around us. This, she says, is because the moment we do something different from our usual routine, the more fresh energy, hope, and blessings we will manifest in our life. This allows us, she suggests, to move from seeing things as tedious to realizing the preciousness of everything. School Days is prepared and engineered here in the Del Norte KHSU studio for the KHSU magazine by Susan Andrews, school psychologist for the Del Norte County Unified School District.
And donors to KHSU include Eureka's Black Fawn Gallery for February. The gallery is showing the work of painters Fennel Blythe, Richard Dooning. Photographer Stilson Snow will also be on display. Learn more at blackfawnart.com. And the gallery is also located on Facebook. Thanks to everyone who contributed to today's KHSU magazine. Thanks to Michael Roccoforte and Fred McLaughlin for the calendar. Thanks to North Coast Update and School Days producer Susan Andrews. and to our KHSU Magazine producer, Katie Whiteside. Thanks so much to our guests, Kyle Morgan of the HSU Library, Dr. James Gash, and Dr. Joseph DMA, who will be attending the HSU Authors Hall celebration today on the second floor of the library. It's going on from 3:30 to 5 o'clock p.m. today. Go by. And for more information, you can go to the library.humboldt.edu/about/HSU authors. Stay tuned for Art Waves with Wendy Butler.
Thank you for tuning into KHSU, and this is Art Waves. I'm Wendy Butler with two interviews today. Later in the program, the director and two of the actors in Redwood Curtain's latest production, Emily La Marquise du Châtelet, defends her life tonight. First today, it's good vibes. The trio is composed of Mike LaBolle, Matthew McClyman, and Jonathan Kipp.